This week on Making Contact.
If you talk to someone about work and, you know, how's the job going? Oh, great. You know, and you talk to them 15 minutes longer, all of a sudden it's not so great. And you start hearing about the frustrations and the fact that they've got to put in this extra time, that they're not getting compensated for it, that they're being pulled away from things more important to them.
We have to rebuild a social movement in this country around the questions of economic justice.
Workers today are earning less than they did when Richard Nixon was president, with adjustments for inflation, and families are deeper in debt than ever before. The United States leads industrial nations with the widest gap between rich and poor. On this roundtable edition, we look at some of the reasons for this disparity amidst the celebration of a booming economy, and some ways to boost incomes for working people. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. For a large majority of our lives, we work. According to federal statistics, we're working harder and longer hours, but overall pay is stagnant, if not declining. That is, unless we're top executives in Fortune 500 companies, executive compensation, according to many observers, is off the scale. So why, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average surpassing the 10,000 mark in the spring of 1999, are many of us struggling to make ends meet and often working in jobs that don't fulfill our desires for meaningful and inspiring lives? To explore these and other questions, we're joined by Amy Dean, Executive Officer for the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council based in San Jose, California. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And Daniel Levine, founder of the online magazine Disgruntled, which has been dubbed the business magazine for people who work for a living. Levine also published a book with the same title in September 1998, Disgruntled, The Darker Side of Work. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, Dan, your subtitle implies that there's a dark side and then a darker side. Well, what's the dark side?
I think the dark side is that you have to get up every morning and do it. I think the darker side is that you not only have to get up and do it, but you have to do it in an environment which is really stacked against the rights of the worker in the workplace, that it's a place where the employer has most of the power, other than your ability to walk out and say, I quit.
Mm-hmm. Your magazine and your book looked at many different tales from workers that kind of show that dilemma, I guess. Can you talk about that? Maybe some examples for us?
Sure. I mean, you know, we went online in November of 1995, and I guess it was one of the unintentional consequences of being on the internet that it does allow that type of dialogue with readers. And, you know, we've heard workplace horror stories across the board. But, you know, what I think a lot of it comes down to is that until people are confronted with their lack of rights in the workplace and their inability to really enforce what rights there are because of an environment of at-will employment, which basically says, you know, barring some kind of statutory violation, your employer can fire you at will. You know, there's this sense of powerlessness in that you have to sit there and either take the abuse or figure out some other way to pay your mortgage.
So lots of people just kind of grinning and burying it then?
Well, certainly the people we hear from. I mean, there are certainly people we hear from that have found ways for addressing that, some conventional, some not so conventional. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of times people, they don't grin and bear it, they become numb to it and desensitized and just accept it. And, you know, it's like if you talk to someone about work and, you know, how's the job going? Oh, great. You know, and you talk to them 15 minutes longer, all of a sudden it's not so great. And you start hearing about the frustrations and the fact that they've got to put in this extra time, that they're not getting compensated for it, that they're being pulled away from things more important to them. So, you know, there's kind of, I think, this frame of mind that a lot of people put themselves in to get them through the day.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amy Dean, the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council, works with employees in the Silicon Valley, among other places. It's the high-tech mecca. And what are you hearing from workers in that region?
I think the hallmark of the new economy demonstrates that there is growing insecurity for people at both ends of the labor market, whether you work at the very high end or you work at the low end, and as we know, there's very little in between, that there's growing insecurity across the board. I think what's happening is that in spite of the fact that there's record-breaking unemployment, it's the qualitative nature of employment is changing dramatically, and that while there's plenty of jobs to be had, the fact is that the nature or the quality of those jobs is really deteriorating, and that There's no such thing as permanent employment. People kind of move in and out of the workforce in a very kind of fluid way. Not benefits not associated with that. The risk of kind of the ebbs and flows of the cycle being borne by the individual. And so we see what's happening for people really almost in every sector of the new economy, working with greater and greater uncertainty. Last thing I'll say is that if you look at the fastest growing occupations within Silicon Valley as well as California, the 10 fastest growing occupations all pay below $15 an hour. And so we've got massive job growth, but the quality and the pay of those jobs is really declining.
Huh. And $15 an hour, below $15 an hour, what does that get you these days?
Well, in Santa Clara County, it takes one mother and child to be self-sufficient, that's to be off of any public assistance, to subsist at the bare bone minimum, $12.42 an hour. And that's no frills or thrills. That's just paying your bills to rent an apartment and paying your groceries and transportation and child care, and that's it.
One of the things people have sought out as a solution is a trend called downshifting, which is basically abandoning some of their consumer lifestyle and learning to spend less in order to work less. Now, some of that has come about from people who have had to confront this in a very involuntary way. They've been in good jobs in middle management and suddenly in their late 40s, early 50s have been downsized and find they can't go out and get work at the same level that they had. They're taking jobs for half the salaries they were enjoying or less. And in many ways, though, what we're finding is that people are finding that once they get over the this need to spend, that they are finding a more satisfying and rewarding life, particularly if it's associated with cutting back on work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a solution for some people. Generally, that's not easily done for people with young children going through school or...
Mm-hmm. Now, we're told with this kind of, you know, rapid job changes that some people have to go through that... tough, you know, get used to it. Here's some training programs, et cetera, so that you can switch back and forth between jobs. Is that a viable solution, Amy?
Well, I think that, that we will not turn back the clocks. I mean, the fact that work increasingly is short-term and temporary, I don't believe will change. I think that is a response to the growing volatility of a global marketplace. It's a response to the massive shifts that have taken place in the economy. It's a function of technology moving in and out of the workforce to perform work. And not necessarily be connected to a job per se is not going to go away. So the question becomes for us is what is the next set of institutions responsible for governing the economy look like? What's government's role in this new mix? What's the next generation of labor organizations need to look like in this new mix? And what's the role of our training infrastructure, workforce development, community colleges? What's their role in trying to figure out how we mediate or absorb the risk for individuals? And I think it's nothing short of massive transformation in all of our institutions and a call for a new social contract in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe you can pick up on that point. You were talking earlier about contingent or temporary labor, and your labor council that you work with published a report in 1996 on this growing sector. And I interviewed you around the time for the AFL-CIO's radio program On Target, and you were talking about organizing temps. What's going on now?
Well, we launched a project, two initiatives at the beginning of this year. One is a general membership organization called Together at Work. We've signed up our first 100 members this year. We just launched the project. The membership organization is building portable benefits. We've got three benefit plans that will be coming online by this summer, health plans for people who can come in, who need to move from job to job through membership of Together at Work. We're building a pension plan, and over time, the goal will be to subsidize a portion of the pension and health benefits for members as time goes on. The second initiative that we launched is something called Solutions, which is a staffing agency. And the goal is to enter into the labor market, broker supply and demand of labor in clerical/technical sector. We're placing people at $2 higher than the average that our industry competitors are placing because we're not taking a 50% profit margin. The fact that we're taking a smaller profit margin and we're rolling the profits back into the human resource development of members of Solutions puts us in a situation to be able to pay people more, still solve and meet the needs of the employer community, but create a decent wage for people who are working in this short-term situation. The last thing, the last goal of Solutions as an actual formal labor market actor is to build stability for people because of linking enough employers together so that if your assignments are short term, by virtue of having a relationship with Solutions, you'll be able to come in and out of different assignments and be gainfully employed longer term in spite of the fact that employment is short term and inconsistent.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dan, if we're looking at this kind of new work environment, there are many, we know many people who are relatively highly skilled, college educated, know a dozen software programs, et cetera, able to get employment with Corporation X, Corporation Y, week after week after week. What do you think that does for the individual, in a sense, that if they're kind of marketing these skills and acting essentially as kind of educated drones in a way?
Well, you know, the biggest problem goes back to what I think Amy was saying about this need for a new social contract. A lot of times, because people are working in this manner, they don't have the same rights and the same benefits that are afforded to employees. And I think the real key is, if we're going to accept that there is no turning back the clock, which I think is true, that there's this new way that people are working, what I think we really have to look at is building the same types of protections and safety net and benefit structure that employees 20, 30 years ago could assume was a given. I think that's really more of a political problem than a workplace problem, and one that, you know, unfortunately, given the politics today, is hard to bring about change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There seems to be the separation between politics and the economy in the way you both are discussing. Is that kind of a problem with today's society, in a sense that the economy operates kind of separately from the political structure, really?
Well, I think it's a great point in that, you know, less than 25 years ago in this country, we made economic decisions because they were a vehicle or a means toward achieving certain social and political values that we had as a nation. Somewhere along the way in the last 25 years, we stopped making economic decisions as a means to an end, and we started making economic decisions in an attempt to build an environment of competitiveness, as though competitiveness was somehow the end in and of itself. And so we have lost track of what the goal is. Now, in the midst of having that happen in the last 20 years, a lot of people have, you know, seemed to believe that the forces of the economy are somehow equivalent to the laws of nature, and they're not. And the fact is, economic decisions take place because people make political decisions that inform them. And to the extent that people can make good political decisions or bad political decisions suggests that we all have the ability to shape and form and impact the way our economy grows or doesn't grow.
Mm-hmm. Do you think then that large multinational corporations, for example, hold too much power in making those economic decisions that affect so many lives?
I think that historically in our country, we've always tried to maintain a balance between, on the one hand, the forces of the market and the values that we hold as a nation. And throughout history, there are periods where one is more out of whack than the other. I mean, clearly, we're going through a period now where the forces of the market reign, and that, you know, the market is the highest institution to which all others are subservient. And so it's so out of balance and so out of whack that while I don't have any romantic notions about us being able to rebuild power, but I'm also optimistic about the fact that it is so out of balance that being able to reassert a politics of compassion that attempts to balance again the forces is, I think, the window and the door is opening right now.
That was Amy Dean, Executive Officer for the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council. We're also joined by Daniel Levine, author of Disgruntled, The Darker Side of Work.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tape and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736.
We now return to our roundtable discussion with Amy Dean, Executive Officer of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council, and Daniel Levine, author of Disgruntled, The Darker Side of Work. I asked Amy and Dan about a report issued in April 1999 by the Boston-based group United for a Fair Economy. The report, Shifting Fortunes, The Perils of the Growing Wealth Gap in America, presents conclusions by the economist Edward Wolfe of New York University, a leading authority on wealth distribution. He and his co-authors found that the top 1% of households in the United States controls 40% of the wealth.
We've had tax policies and political policies that have rewarded asset owners and penalized wage earners.
Yeah, I think that we're definitely need to look at what kinds of political reforms that we can have. I agree absolutely that there has been tax policies that have not rewarded wage earners and have created incentives for those at the high end. I think that there are lots of things that we can do to restore balance. The first is that we need to build back parity into our National Labor Relations Act, the body of law that's primarily responsible for governing relationships between employee and employer. We need to once again make it a right for people to bargain collectively in this country. People do not have the right to bargain collectively in this country. We have lost that right. The law has been whittled away in the last 30 years. The law has been rendered impotent because of changes in the economy. We need to make the right to organize the premier civil rights issue of this next century. That's one thing. The second thing is we need massive reform with employment law. We need to ensure that those people who are not working on some kind of permanent fixed basis can be covered for unemployment for periods where they're separated from the workforce. In other words, employment policies and so many of our social constructs like workers' comp and other things assume a permanent fixed relationship between employee and employer. We need to reform those policies to accommodate the new ways people go to work. Creating the political space and will is a whole other matter. But once we do that, and I believe we'll do that because of a resurgent labor movement, it's then a question of ensuring that once the door opens, it won't open automatically, it won't open without a fight in this country, but once the door does open, that there, I don't think there's any shortage of, you know, obvious reforms that we need.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's possible, you know, particularly labor act reform with the two-party system where, you know, there's the choices to support the Democrats or
I think that
or not.
I think that the only thing that brings about the next wave of reform, specifically it relates to your question around labor law reform, is we're going to have to heat it up in this country. We're going to have to make the right to organize a major civil rights issue. We have to rebuild a social movement in this country around the questions of economic justice. And I think once we build a social movement, we'll begin to create the space and will. We will not create the space and will by playing inside politics, but we do absolutely need the Democrats to be in power to create the space for us to go about pushing the envelope so that we can bring about reform.
Maybe you both talk about the political space that some workers are encountering in their workplaces, either the individual who pursues a workers' comp claim or an individual who's interested in getting more information from labor to, you know, decide on how to organize or if organizing is viable in the workplaces. What stories are you hearing, Dan?
On the organizing side?
On organizing. Or workers' comp claims? What's it like for workers?
Well, I think as an AFL-CIO figure, 10,000 people a year are fired from their jobs for organizing activity, even though that's illegal to do. It's a very unfriendly environment. It's an environment where the employer has gotten a lot of power in the organizing process as far as running a no campaign. It's a very difficult and uncomfortable place, I think, for workers to find themselves, and it's something they do with great risk to their future employment there. It's still, you know, even so, people are organizing every day, but the odds are stacked against them because we've had 30 years of labor laws and judicial decisions that have been very much stacked against them.
You cited some cases in your book about workers who claimed or made workers' comp claims, and they were essentially blackballed when they went looking for the jobs.
There are now databases that employers can tap into that can find out, you know, when you go for a job without you being aware of an employer or a potential employer doing this, they can certainly tap into databases and find out, have you ever filed a workers' comp claim? Have you ever sued a previous employer? You know, they'll look at a whole host of financial records and driver's records, and, you know, do a lot of homework in a very short amount of time for a very small amount of money given the new technology. And there are, I think, very serious issues of privacy concerns that are raised around that are poorly addressed today.
Is it legal to conduct such searches?
Sure. It is. There have been people who have done things that are illegal, but, you know, there's no kind of omnibus privacy act that addresses workplace privacy rights. you know, the place where you see this, these types of issues addressed legally are things like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which basically, as long as the employer discloses that he's going to do this and you've given him permission to do that, they can do that. But, you know, we hear of people applying for jobs where people are doing credit checks that have, you know, no access to money. They're not going to be, you know, it's not like they're a bank teller or something. And it leads to very bizarre decisions in hiring.
Hmm. Amy?
The largest private sector organizing drive was just one at Stanford Hospital just a couple of months ago, which represented almost 2,000 workers who were able to persevere in spite of massive employer intimidation. It was a traditional election that was won through the labor board. And typically in those situations where you go through the labor board, all the rules are stacked against you. The employer can have access to the employees and intimidate them 24 hours a day. We can't even walk on the workplace and talk with people. There was tons of intimidation, tons of harassment that went on. To hear the employees of that facility testify is just heart-wrenching when you hear what they went through. It's amazing. What helped them to be successful, and I think this is the common thread that you see across the board in successful organizing drives right now around the country, is when community leaders come forward and lend their moral stature to supporting the rights of employees to choose for themselves without interference from their employer about whether they want to have representation or not.
Just to expand on that a little, there was actually an interesting body of research that was recently published by a group of academics through Cornell University. Kate Broffenbauer, Organizing to Win was the book. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Amy. But, you know, one of the things they did was, and I think it's rare to see academics spending this type of time and energy on analyzing union organizing, at least from an employee side. But, you know, one of the things they found that organizing campaigns that were successful in partially because the issues they were focusing on weren't micro issues of wages or conditions, but really broader issues of rights and justice and issues that extend beyond that workplace, and issues where, you know, an employer can't walk in the door and say, okay, you know, we're giving you a 50-cent raise, you don't need this union, and make that issue go away temporarily. And I think that's kind of one of the thing that people who are not organized really look to the labor movement still to kind of be a champion of all workers' rights, and look for these types of social justice issues to be really fought for by the labor movement and reach out and to a broader community.
Mm-hmm. Well, meanwhile, as workers are struggling for even the right to organize in some cases, executive compensation is, according to some, running away, really. I'm going to read something. This is from the AFL-CIO's website. They have an executive pay watch, and they say, according to Business Week, the average CEO of a major corporation made 42 times the pay of a typical American factory worker in 1980. By 1990, that ratio had more than doubled to 85 times the average factory wage, and almost quintupled again to a staggering 419 times more in 1998. That's an issue that you talk about in your book, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the whole notion, what really led to this kind of explosion in CEO compensation was this notion of pay for performance. And it's become a total joke, and it's become is kind of a vicious cycle where, you know, a CEO looks across the street and points to the board that just granted his competitor a raise and a new round of options, and you know, puts his compensation committee on the job to up his own. What's even made it, I think, worse is that boards have been fairly free at repricing options. That once a CEO's pay is going to be pegged to stock performance, so he's granted a series of options at the current market price, but the stock falters and it's down $20 from where it was when he got the options grant. And the board, rather than saying, well, this CEO hasn't performed and he's not going to get that reward, instead says, well, we've got to keep this guy incentivized and we don't want to lose him to competitors, so we're going to reprice those options and drop them, you know, 20 points. And that money, it's kind of imaginary, I think, to a lot of people. But the fact of the matter is, you're transferring wealth, and it's got to come from somewhere. It's got to come from either the shareholders or the employees or the customers of the company. It has to come from somewhere. It doesn't just get taken out on paper. It's not something that's just created that way. And I think it's it goes back to what we've talked about, the shifting economy, shifting fortunes report. It's really helped exaggerate this disparity between the wealthy people in the workplace and everyone else.
Well, moving on, there are some solutions that are on the table. Amy, you were mentioning one, which is organizing temporary workers, the contingent workforce. The other one has to do with living wage campaigns that are taking place in, I believe, approximately 16 cities across the United States. Maybe you can talk about what a living wage campaign is.
Well, they've been very strategic tools in really bringing together the kinds of groups and constituencies that really need to come together. You know, in the last 30 years, the progressive community and progressive politics has really fallen and kind of been parked in an enclave of identity politics. And it's not, it's only been very until very recently, which I think is a function of a resurgent labor movement, that we've begun to reconstitute notions of liberalism in this country that are centered in the context of what we have in common as opposed to what we don't have in common. These living wage campaigns are a great example of that point, where you see a broad alliance of constituencies that haven't talked for many years coming together to put the question of equity and social justice front and center in the community as a premier issue that needs to be addressed. And so there have been, I think it's 19 or 20 cities now across the country where people have been successful in passing public policies that link public contracts, usually at the city level, to a minimum wage standard. Typically what people think is necessary to live at within the particular region. In San Jose, we passed one this past year in November, and it was the highest wage in the country. We also have provisions in it so that employers who are willing to be neutral in organizing drives will get preferential treatment in the bidding process. And there's also a component that addresses the issue of retention of employees so that when contractors come and go, you know, this issue of fluidity that we talked about earlier, that employees won't be hired or fired, but that if employees are continuing to do a good job, they will remain. So it's a question of wages, retention, and then this issue of preferential treatment for employers who want to be neutral.
Have businesses stopped doing business with the city of San Jose because of rising costs or anything like that?
In all the instances where the oldest actually living wage policies in Baltimore, it was passed in 1994, and so we have the most amount of data from that one. The rest of them are relatively young. There's been no examples in Baltimore, no examples in Los Angeles. San Jose is too early to tell.
And with that, there, you know, going back to Baltimore, there's been a significant impact on the lives of those workers as far as improving their standard of living.
Right.
Well, I've been speaking with Amy Dean. She's the executive officer of the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council based in San Jose. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Great. And Dan Levine, founder of the online magazine Disgruntled, which has been dubbed the business magazine for people who work for a living. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at the growing wage disparity in America and how workers are responding. Thanks for listening. We have production assistance from Stephanie Welch and Rosie Reyes. Laura Thevadi is our managing director. Peggy Law is executive director. Our production assistant is Shireen Meraji. Norman Solomon is senior advisor. Our national producer is David Barsamian. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.